The eagle has landed.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
I consider myself the luckiest man.
I have a dream today.
That the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Hello, you're listening to Speaking of History, the podcast that has a focus on education, technology, and history. My name is Eric Langhorst. I'm an 8th grade American history teacher in Liberty, Missouri, a suburb just outside of Kansas City. And today you're listening to podcast number 106, being recorded on July 8th, 2007, in the heart of Philadelphia. Well, I'm waiting for the Constitution Center workshop to begin tomorrow. That's going to be a really exciting week. I did have kind of a free day here in Philadelphia, so I wanted to see a couple of the sites outside the city, things that I teach about and have really wanted to experience for a long time. And so I actually got the help of Pat Hughes to show me around a little bit and also share with the experience. Pat is actually the author of a book that we use for our book blog project called Guerrilla Season, and Pat lives here in Philadelphia, and she's been very gracious to help me out and kind of show me around a little bit. So today we had two main objectives. We wanted to see Valley Forge, and then we also wanted to go to Washington's Crossing. Now, since they're on kind of separate ends of the city of Philadelphia, and actually outside the city of Philadelphia, we had to kind of budget our time a little bit. So we knew that we wouldn't be able to see everything at both sites, but we wanted to kind of hit just a couple things at each. So we went up to Valley Forge first, and went to the visitor center. Saw a lot of artifacts and did some different things up there. And then we went to a reenactment of a camp. Obviously, they have lots of reconstructed huts at Valley Forge, just like they had during the winter there with Washington. And they actually had two individuals there today that were demonstrating things like what the clothing would have looked like, what the soldiers would have ate. And I was able to record a little presentation that they did on that, and then also recorded kind of a question and answer session that I had with one of the other individuals. So here are two clips from the encampment at Valley Forge from soldiers or people portraying soldiers at Valley Forge in that winter.
Out here we try and represent the typical Continental soldiers you would have seen at Valley Forge. And this time of year, most soldiers, because it was hot out, and because it was easier to get for the men, they'd be wearing these hunting shirts that I'm wearing. This is my coat, this is my uniform, if I'm an American soldier. Now, other countries in that time period, they didn't have such a coat. This is because the Continental Army was poor and didn't have enough money to buy the usual coats you would see on soldiers in that time period. If you would see the British Army, they'd wear these red coats, very fancy. This is a private's coat, not an officer coat. And the lace pattern on there is specific to the British 64th Regiment. You can see the 64 buttons on there. Okay, so tailored, 42 buttons. Every soldier has one of these. They're all bright red. Very fancy. Whereas in the American Army, the equivalent was this blue coat, or brown, depending on the time of the war. And the idea was that the soldiers, okay, we're all in the Continental Army, right? But we will have different colored facings, or this red here, for our state or our regiment. And a lot of Pennsylvania, Virginia, Maryland soldiers wore red facings. You'd see white and brown and some other colors for facings on there. But what they were trying to do was to get the soldiers and the citizens to think of this as the new United States. Okay? And the most common button on this, although this coat says, what are those initials there?
PSR.
And what would you think the P would stand for? Pennsylvania. So this is the Pennsylvania State Regiment, and one of the 13 Pennsylvania regiments of Valley Forge. And they might wear that button. They also might wear a USA button. I think I have one up here on my sleeve. And that is the most typical button you would find on these coats. And they would try and make this a symbol like the American flag that started out in 1777. And the money, which you see over there, the paper Continental money, as a symbol of the new United States. They were trying to get everybody into one cause. But if you picture the Continental Army, like the Army came through Philadelphia in August of 1777, before they started fighting the British for this area in Pennsylvania. And General Washington had the army parade through the city to show the civilians that they had a real army that would defend them. What the soldiers did that day, because of this big variety in clothing, is that they put one thing in their hat that was the same. Now, in the enlisted men's hat, and I'm wearing a round hat, not a tricorn or cocked hat, because a lot of soldiers wear these round hats like this, is that you would have the black cockade there, see that? And this would be the symbol of the American Army. And also my rank. It shows that I'm not an officer, but I wear the black cockade. And that if you have anything, if you're enlisted, if you're a sergeant or corporal, you might wear a red or green epaulet on your shoulder. So you can tell what rank I am from at least 50 yards away. You can see who I am. If it's an officer, you might see a green for lieutenant or white for captain in the hat. So at a distance, it's pretty easy to get a little square of cloth to represent something rather than 20, 30, 40,000 tailored regimental coats. An army cannot afford that. Coats they did get probably came from France, or their state was diligent in getting them for them. Now the other thing you see in my hat is what? A decoration?
Feather.
Feathers? Bear skin? The soldiers in 1777 put a sprig of green in their hat. That was something everybody could get, a sprig of evergreen. They stuck it in their hat. And they looked the best they could in the uniform. To show their spirit. They all have one thing the same. The green sprig. The black cockade. A lot of times the Americans wanted to show they were different than the British. This is the army they were fighting. They had to learn to fight like the British because of the muscles. We'll talk about it in a minute. But the Americans were proud of being different, of being a little more independent. So you see them sticking those feathers and things like that in their hats. It's kind of a symbol. They were independent. So what's the song Yankee Doodle? Where the Yankee Doodle stick in his hat. Feather in his hat and called it macaroni. It means he was cool. Macaroni was a fancy dude translation. And so what it was kind of like a showing the British that we don't care about all your fancy clothes and, you know, fancy muskets and things like that. Because the British would try to intimidate you. Now they were wearing white, these are called their small clothes, the pants and the vest and everything. That's your small clothes. But you wore your coat over that. Now imagine the British shows up in white on a day like today, and the stuff's like all bleached in the sun, real white, bright. They come up over the horizon in those red coats. And oftentimes, the guys who they send up the hill to fight you are the British Grenadiers, hand-picked men, put off in their regiment. And they're all 6 feet tall plus 200 pounds, and they wear these tall bearskin hats. And they're coming up the hill at you. This could be very intimidating, right? Early in the war, the Americans, like at Bunker Hill, they shot up the Grenadiers, but the Grenadiers captured that hill. That was their motto. Nec aspera terrent. Difficulties began. If you want us to take that hill, we're glad you picked us, because it looks like it's a tough job, and that's what we're here for. That's what we live for. As the war goes on, and the Americans fight the British down here at the Battle of Brandywine, 2,000 of these British Grenadiers that try and climb the hill up against the Americans, that don't have a fort to hide behind anymore, and they're shot to pieces for a while. And they have to lay down on the ground, and they don't take the hill. It's a seesaw battle for that hill, back and forth for 45 minutes. So the American Army had come a long way by the time they got to Valley Forge. And they had done a lot of marching, and they'd been together a while, and fought in battle. So, I mean, the key to this army here was that most of the soldiers enlisted for the duration of the war. And early in the war, you could sign up for 6 months or a year and then go home. So Washington was the first 2 years of the war. He's fighting with soldiers as kind of in rotation. And they may not be the same ones coming back. Some did, some didn't. But in 77, they did sign up finally for the duration. And that meant he would have seasoned veterans finally to fight the British with. And the British Army was, you know, it was good, there were no doubt. They were veteran and professional. And if you didn't outnumber them 3-1, going to go at them on equal terms. And Washington, when he fought the British in the Philadelphia campaign, was outmanned too. He was not just outgunned, he was outnumbered. So they did pretty well. Now at Valley Forge, the big part of our story is that this army got trained. And what they did was they kind of broke things down, and we have guys from different states doing it different ways a little bit. Back then, it was very hard for General Washington to get the states to cooperate together, because they weren't unified, really. They were fighting the British. It was the United States of America on paper, but really, get people to cooperate. Okay? I need shirts sent up from Georgia. It didn't always happen. So when they got here, Baron von Steuben came to camp, saw a very dedicated army that would put up with a lot of hardships, but he saw that lack of discipline and the lack of doing things the same, basically. Different styles of cabins a little bit. Some of that was just due to, we don't have enough axes, and we had to throw them up quick. But in the British Army and other armies in that time period, everybody did everything exactly the same. Put out your blanket for inspection, built your huts the same, and that would all change at Valley Forge. The Army forever after this would be everything the same. And in battle, is important that you stay together. And let me explain about the musket, because that kind of goes hand in hand with the way they fought the battles back then. Is that I got a reproduction of the French musket, which is one of the typical guns that France was sending over to us. And colleague over there has an American musket, a nice cherry stock, but not really standardized. And those would be more expensive. The Army would have probably more of these French ones because they were cheaper and easier to get for soldiers. But they're both flintlocks. They're identical in the way that they fire. And without fumbling around for powder horns or anything like that, the system was you had a cartridge, and inside the cartridge was a musket ball, and generally also three buckshot together. And so all you had to do was take one out of your box, open it with your special opening tools, pour powder into the pan, shut down the pan there, take the rest of the powder, goes down the barrel loosely, and then the musket balls will be undersized. And I'm not sure which I got. I got the wrong ones. They're for your gun. See that? The British one, it fits easy down there. See that? And there's the thing. We have an undersized musket ball. The reason is we can ram it down real easy, not have it foul up in there, because the black powder is real dirty and it will foul up the bore. Now it's at half cock still, so the fire, we go to full cock, and when the flint hits the steel, it makes a spark, right? Flips open the pan, sets off the priming, and then through a little vent hole there, sets off the charge in the barrel. So it's all done very efficiently, quickly, 3 to 4 shots a minute with these cartridges and training. And everybody can be trained to do it. You don't have to be a marksman or a specialist. The rifles they had back at that time were specialized guns. They were deadly accurate. They say in that time period, a rifleman could hit an orange at 200 yards with open sights. This musket ball would travel 200 yards. You might be able to hit a barn with it at 200 yards. But let's say at 50 yards, you could probably consistently hit the hut door over there with this gun. And in most battles, the crux of it comes 50, 100 yards, you're firing a volley. These guns are designed for everybody to roll up in lines, in double ranks, and fire these booming volleys. Everybody fires at once. So you're trying to send out as much lead into the air, just kind of transforming a line into a giant shotgun. Much lead out there as possible. You're not aiming at one individual British soldier. You're pointing the gun in that direction and aiming low and getting some musket balls to go in their direction. And really, it's deadly, it's warfare, but it's like the British Grenadiers. You're trying to intimidate, you're trying to be steady and break their will. You make them break and run. That's the name of the game. Okay? And that's why they fought in those lines, because these muskets, that's the animal you're dealing with. This is the gun, this is the technology. Something goes on the end of the musket, which is the ultimate weapon in that time period. What is that, anybody?
A bayonet.
And these more modern bayonets would be off to the side, so you would load and fire with it on there, it's ready to be used. All you have to do is level it to have a bayonet charge. And those guys would come forward in a bayonet charge, just like the musket volleys. Controlled, steady, even. So here at Valley Forge, the Army practiced bayonet charges and firing a little bit, but mostly marching. To march in unison, everybody marches the same. Standardize our marching step. And when Baron von Steuben started with like a small group of 50 people, eventually spread out to the regiments, the brigades, and by May, they were over on our Grand Parade Ground marching in unison. Okay. That was the first time the Army had, to my knowledge, practiced together. It's kind of mind-blowing considering they were fighting a war for 3 years and not all got out on the same practice ground and practiced together. So, a miracle they'd done as well as they had. But that was the key, getting everybody to do it together so that when they would fight in future battles down south or wherever you found them, they would hold their own against the British just about every time. And if they didn't want to win a battle, they could conduct an orderly retreat and get their men out of there and save face, and nobody thought that was shameful in any way back then. You turned around and retreated from a battle, that was considered to be, you know, part of what you did, and no big deal. The other thing that was important about Valley Forge is learning how to build cabins and survive. Because the next winters after Valley Forge, these guys would camp out each winter until 1783. And they better have known how to build a log cabin and take care of themselves and polish their gun and stay clean and be inspected, because that was key to their health and survival of the army. It had to be in the field for five more years. So what we're going to do, Steve and I, is we're going to walk out into the field right over here and fire two shots. The first shot we fire will be according to the training commands. And this, you see, will be how the soldiers will learn, like the steps. But also, they probably go through there every morning or every couple times they train just to keep up their cadence, because they want to do everything together. And when they speeded it up and went to the combat commands, it's load, make ready, take aim, and fire. And so we'd still do it in unison, but we do it. Well, I don't think we're going to do it in 15 seconds today, considering how we feel and how the weather is. But, you know, they would be able to do that in the Continental Army. And then sometimes, actually, while they were marching, they could load and fire. So the two shots will be the end of our talk here. And at that time, if you guys have questions, want to look for the musket closer. And we didn't have a chance to much talk about what's on the blanket over there. So you want to come back and check out some of those things, and we'd be happy to help you do that. I will warn you that the muskets are somewhat loud, so be prepared for kind of a boom and when we fire. And we always like to think of the shots as a commemoration of what the soldiers did here and their time served here. Didn't fight any battles, but they lost close to 2,000 men here from disease. And it wasn't like the soldiers didn't know that when they signed up. So I think credit's due to these guys, because when you, second, third year of the war, people knew that when you joined an army, there was probably a 1 in 10 or better chance you weren't coming back, just simply from getting some camp disease, not to even mention the British musket balls.
Really good question. All right, what about the food rations at Valley Forge? What was the typical day like for a soldier here as far as eating?
Well, what the soldiers are supposed to receive and what they're really receiving are two different things. Supposed to get meat, bread, some type of vegetable every day. Pound and a half of beef, about a pound of pork, or 3/4 of a pound of fish, salt fish. Now what happens though is that the army doesn't always have that to provide for the soldiers. You have to imagine 12,000 soldiers, a pound and a half of meat every day. That's over 6 tons of meat every single day. The army just cannot provide that. So there are food shortages where all the soldiers are getting is one loaf of bread every day. The other thing you have to realize too is that this isn't like going to the grocery store and buying boneless, skinless chicken breasts. These are cattle that are driven into camp, slaughtered once they're here, and then handed out. So you might get a pound and a half of something. It might not always be meat. One soldier says, yes, I got a pound and a half of something. 3/4 of that was rotten. The rest of it was bone. So what the soldiers are supposed to get and what they're getting, not always the same thing. They're ordered to boil most of their food, because sometimes you're getting very old meat, and boiling it will help to kill some of the stuff that's in it. Now, the soldiers liked the grilled flavor, but they're supposed to be boiling things.
So did the dietary concerns contribute to the amount of disease and things in the camp?
Absolutely that did. When you're not eating as healthy as you're supposed to be, add into that some sickness and disease floating around camp, your body is already a little weak to begin with. And then you add in some sickness and disease flooding through camp, and that just really increases the problem.
So throughout the winter, what was the typical day like for most soldiers? A lot of waiting around, or I mean, what did they do during the day?
Not actually very busy. So what you're going to do is wake up early in the morning. Generally, winter time early in the morning is going to be around 8 o'clock, and you're going to go off for inspection. And inspection is where you take out all of your equipment, lay it out on your blanket, and demonstrate to your officers that you have all of the equipment that you are supposed to have. Now, soldiers are kept a journal to outline if they have any problems. For example, my musket broke the last time I was here. My ramrod got lost in a battle. If you're found that you're in missing something and you don't have a valid excuse, then your pay is stopped until that is repaid to the government. So you start off with inspection, very, very important. Next thing is you probably go out for a couple hours of work detail, where you're going to go out, gather water, gather food, gather, if you're on forage duty, gather food, gather wood for your fireplaces. Then you're going to come back probably for another inspection mid-afternoon. Have your afternoon meal, which is generally going to be the big meal of the day. And then you're going to go out for training in the afternoon evening. And generally by dark, around 6 or 7, then you're left free time to do what you want. Now, there's not supposed to be any gambling or anything like that in camp, but that's what's going on at night. Card games, dice, things like that. That's a typical day. Now, there is all sorts of atypical things going on where soldiers are sent out on picket duty or forage detail, sent out to gather supplies and sent outside of camp for other things. But for the soldier who's here every day, that's going to be kind of what his life consists of.
Was there any danger of the British attacking this encampment during the winter?
For the first few weeks, there is danger of an attack. General Washington is very aware that the British might come out here and just try to finish the war right here at Valley Forge. The reason the British never come out to attack is because of the way this encampment is set up. It's the defensive lines that are set up. General Washington arrives here, commands the high ground. They start cutting down trees for their fireplaces, for their log cabins. By the end of the encampment, they will have cleared out a 3-mile radius of trees. What you have is wide open space all around camp with fortified soldiers on a ridgeline. Now, if the British choose to attack against this ridgeline, that's an uphill fight against fortified, entrenched Continental soldiers. They might be able to overrun the camp, but it's going to be very deadly. Might have to have 12,000 to 15,000 soldiers attack this encampment, and you're probably going to lose half because of that uphill battle. The British just aren't willing to take that risk.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
There are a couple of clips from two individuals that were portraying soldiers at Valley Forge during Washington's winter. And it was really neat. They also did a little reenactment of what it was like to fire their muskets. And I actually filmed that. And I'm going to probably use that in class this next year with my students, because it talks about all the different stages of firing a musket. And they actually did kind of a little charge, a little bayonet charge after that. So I'm going to try and maybe get that on TeacherTube. Right now I just have it in the QuickTime format, so I'd have to do some switching and a little bit of format change. So I'll try and get that up eventually on TeacherTube. Well, after that, we drove down to Washington's headquarters. Washington, during that winter, actually stayed in a house. And fortunately for us, that house is still standing. It's really cool. You can go down and park and then walk down to it. And today, we just happened to luck out and be there at exactly the right time, because they had several individuals there doing a living history presentation. And we walked into the house, and first I talked to an individual that kind of talked a little bit about the history of the house. And so here's a little clip talking about the history of Washington's headquarters at Valley Forge. Hey, can you tell us a little bit about the building we're currently in?
Well, this building that we're currently in is Washington's headquarters. It was originally built as a business office slash manager's house for a grist mill and a sawmill on the Valley Creek. At the time of the encampment, however, it was being used as a rental property. Washington came in and rented this house from the lady who was renting it, who was a cousin or aunt, we're not exactly sure, of the owner. Washington paid her a fair price, and she moved out. Washington came in with his military family, which included about 8 to 10 staff officers and about 10 to 12 servants and slaves. They needed the house because there were so many of them who had to live and work in this small space.
And is this the original structure?
It is. It's about 80 to 85% original. The woodwork is original, pretty much everything, even down to the banister. The things that are not original are the things that are exposed to the elements. Glass, roof, that sort of thing.
So was there any animosity that, you know, Washington was in this house and you had these men? I mean, or did they just understand that that's the way it was going to be?
They understood. Even today, we have an understanding that with rank comes privilege. And as general, he needed the space and he deserved the respect and the position that he had.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. So we're at the headquarters for Washington at Valley Forge that winter. And we walk into the house, and on the second room, there are two people sitting. There is George Washington, and then someone that is basically like a scribe writing down what he's saying, and they're talking about strategy. And I'm telling you, this was absolutely incredible. This person that is portraying George Washington is George Washington in my mind. I mean, he looks exactly the part. He is talking exactly the same way that I would envision George Washington talking. He is answering questions with the same type of answers that I would believe George Washington would use. And he allowed you to ask questions. And I asked him several questions and was able to record it. And I'm telling you, I'm standing there, and Pat thought this as well. I'm standing there, and I'm basically suspending belief, or, you know, suspending reality, I guess, that this is not George Washington. And this was as close as I could imagine talking to George Washington in my lifetime. I mean, this guy was absolutely incredible. One of the people at the house actually said that he's, I believe, now this is, again, just somebody that said this, so, you know, I haven't verified this, but I think he's one of two individuals that actually portrays Washington at Valley Forge. So this guy was amazing. And the following is a little clip interview that I had with George Washington. And there are some other people in the house, so there are times on the clip when there's some background noise and stuff, but I did want to include the entire clip, and I thought he had some really incredible answers, and it was really like I was talking to George Washington. So here's the clip from George Washington.
Sir, obviously you're staying in very nice quarters here. Do you go out to the troops and speak to them in the huts and do some things to kind of find out what's happening in the other parts of Valley Forge?
My troops regulars, you need to understand something. When we marched into this valley in mid-December of 1777, we had 12,000 troops. We were at the end of the rope at that point. And everyone from general to trooper and everything in between was under canvas for the first many weeks that we were here. We began first order of business of shelter with the canvas. Did nothing to cut the cold, sir, but kept the dry and cut the wind. We then started hut building. It became very clear shortly around that time that I needed a formal home. I was receiving members of Congress, receiving foreign dignitaries, and I am running the entire army from this location. So there is still a northern department of this army and a southern department. We are here at Central Command. So I negotiated with Isaac Potts and rented this house for £100, Pennsylvania.
Well, yeah, well, see, what happened is, in 1775, when the war started, it was all...
Huts were being built very successfully, 12-man huts, with the exception of officers' huts, there are fewer. And each one of those huts is dry and warm. You know, senior men closer to the fireplace, junior men further out. And... things improved. We still had very serious issues with clothing, shoes, and food. Congress was of no assistance whatsoever. And so we finally took matters into our own hands. I appointed General Nathaniel Greene as Quartermaster General of the Army. It was not until the Army took matters into its own hands that things improved. Greene dispatched 2,000 troops to scour the area between the Delaware and the Schuylkill Rivers for food and forage, which actually went contrary to my strong beliefs. I do not believe in using the military to seize civilian property, but things were very grave, and we gave receipts. General Wayne was dispatched across the Delaware River into the Jerseys. He came upon some 150 head of cattle. He and General Pulaski were bringing them south and the west back towards the river, towards this encampment. They ran into 4,000 redcoats. They had 500 troops under their command. Our 500 soldiers fought with such ferocity that the British thought that they had come in contact with the vanguard, the very tip of the entire American army. They retreated back to Philadelphia. And Wayne made it back here with his cattle, and things continued to improve. And then they got much better, of course, when the French recognized us in February. We had a major surge of enlistments here. We reached as many as 25,000 people here. Marched in with 12, more than doubled it. And so it is against that background, sir, that a general does certainly go into the population and speaks with his troopers, speaks to the officers. That is the only way to keep the army sustained, sir, and that is what we need to do. Sustain one more day, one more day, one more day. Every time a lobster back drops, he has to be replaced from 3,000 miles away. What we need to do is sustain. Outlast.
Can I ask you a reflective question about an earlier battle? You lost your close personal friend, Mr. Mercer, in the engagement after the crossing. How do you feel as a leader, but then also as a friend, when you order a military campaign or engagement and you lose a close personal friend like that?
As you might expect, sir. War. War is a scourge. There is honor, but it is not the game that I thought it was when I was a young man in the French and Indian War. As a very immature fellow back then, I had written a letter to a brother, my younger brothers, and I wrote to him that I have heard, this is after an attack I had led against the French, I wrote to him that I've heard the bullets whistle, and believe me, there's something charming in the sound, and that comment made it all the way back to the King of England himself, King George II at that time. Do you know what he said, sir, when I got that?
What?
He said if Colonel Washington had been hit by a bullet, his opinion would have been quite different. His attitude would have been quite different. Now, against that background, sir, you understand that to lose a friend at any time, particularly in warfare, particularly in a war that was directed, well, it's not easy.
What do you believe your prospects are for the remainder of the war at this time?
We are cautiously optimistic, sir. We are marching out of here. We have marched out. I'm following with the tail end of the army here. We reconstituted here at the Valley of the Forge. This valley, sir, became the anvil in which the iron will of our revolution was forged. General von Steuben and Divine Providence have come together to put us in a place where we have never been before. We are marching in lockstep. We are wheeling the same way, we are fixing bayonets and firing and reloading all the exact same way. We had 13 different ways of doing everything before. And I think we are, with the support and recognition of France, we are in a good place right now. There are those here who think we are unbeatable. I was just talking to the captain about that this morning. They are wrong. They are wrong. But we are in a much better place than when we marched in.
How do you answer your critics that say you're a coward and that you fail to engage the British and that you are just running and running and running? How do you answer those critics that question your tactics?
Well, sir, you need to understand what their motivations are. That is happening far less since the middle of this past winter. This whole, some call it a conspiracy against me with General Mifflin and Conway and others, Mr. Gates, General Gates, and members of Congress, those who previously supported me. But the wheels have fallen off that cart, sir. And so I cannot say it does not affect me, but I pay it no heed at this juncture, and I'm hearing nothing in the way of criticism at this particular time. If you had been here 3 months ago, 4 months ago, it was a topic of great concern for me. But I will tell you, the wheels were wobbling already when the Congress summoned General Lafayette to their meeting place, York, Pennsylvania. They had fled Philadelphia, went to Lancaster, and they figured they needed a river between themselves and the British. And Lafayette had been recuperating. He was wounded at Brandywine. And he was summoned and given a mission by the Congress at York to invade and capture Canada, which he agreed to do. But he told the Congress he would not do such unless he received the orders from General Washington, his commanding officer. And they begrudgingly acknowledged that and said that that shall occur. And it was that very same evening, again with the wheels wobbling on this cart, sir, trying to replace me and a great number of critics, that Lafayette walked into the Golden Plow Tavern in Yorktown in Pennsylvania. This brings a smile to my face because I can think about it. They're assembled as General Gates, other generals, members of Congress, and they are, according to the General Lafayette, toasting everyone imaginable. And in a very astute move, General Lafayette said, "You know, gentlemen, I have just received some information from the ministers in France that I correspond with regularly. And they have said that the King is most pleased with General Washington's leadership of the army." You understand what that comment did. That comment was a clarion call to the members of Congress and to my staff members that wanted to replace me, that if I was replaced, the King might withdraw his support. Whether that would happen or not, I know not, but General Lafayette made the comment. He then said, "We are toasting everyone, but we have forgotten someone." He stands up, he raises his glass, And he says to General Washington, may he lead the army until independence is won. He describes to me a scene in which members of Congress and members of my staff look down at their boots, clear their throats, rise to their feet, and begrudgingly drink to General Washington. The wheels fell off the car.
Can I ask you one more question, sir?
You may, sir.
In the midst of this conflict, do you ever think about the future and how, what your place will be in history?
Well, I always think of posterity, sir. I would lie to you if I told you I did not. But I am too busy and too engaged with the details of running a war. And on those moments when I can think freely, my thoughts go to places like Mount Vernon. I've not spent a great deal of time in that regard. So I will tell you that I aspire to nothing more than to return to Mount Vernon when this is over. I want to sit under my own vine and my own fig tree and nothing more.
Thank you, sir, and good luck.
My pleasure, sir.
Now, in addition to George Washington, they also had somebody portraying one of the slaves or the servants at the headquarters during the winter, and this was a very interesting perspective from an African-American woman that was portraying a slave at the quarters during the winter. So here's a little clip interview and presentation that was given by one of the people that was portraying, again, a slave or a servant working at Washington's headquarters during that winter at Valley Forge.
Name is Hannah, and yours is?
Eric.
Eric. Oh, fine name. Are you here to work at the General's headquarters?
I'm just a visitor.
Just a visit. Ah, so you're waiting on me to get my supper together for everyone. I see. Well, such is the life of a cook. For His Excellency, what is one more to the 30 that we always feed every day? But I have been with the General for these past 2 years, and I'm quite used to the demands of cooking and feeding the number of people who come here. I am seconded to His Excellency. You do know what that means, sir. Of this time.
No, could you help me?
Yes. Well, I am owned. As you may see, I am a slave here. And I am owned by Reverend John Mason. But when the General needed someone to serve as cook during the New York campaign, he hired my husband, and he hired out myself. So he is our second master. He's as if he is our second master. So therefore, seconded to him, I am. But all of my wages go to my master, Reverend Mason, except for one small portion. You see, General Washington was very much pleased with our service after 1 year. And when he approached Reverend Mason about having us come on and stay for the next campaign, Reverend Mason made an arrangement with His Excellency that as I worked for the General, part of my wages would be set aside so that once I earned 53 pounds, a New York currency, of course, I will be free. I will gain my freedom. So it's through this arrangement that I am still with the General these 2 years. And as long as this war goes on, I'll be able to earn my freedom one coin at a time.
Is that what the medallion represents?
It's what it represents for me, sir. Just one coin at a time.
And that's a 1 pound coin?
This is happens to be a German shilling, but we, as I said, are paying in New York currency. So sometimes, though, you get whatever coinage you may, whatever anyone will accept, as long as it's good, hard coin. It's the metal. So. That's why the British are doing so well in this disaffected country. They are able to pay with hard currency, while we pay with promises of payment. Now, if you're a farmer, which one would you consider payment? What about you, sir?
I think I would take the metal.
Yes, take the metal, because anyone can see the value of the metal. You can go and set the price forever, whatever you wish. There is indeed a lot of bartering that goes on. Trade without any money at all. But if you do have hard currency, you are much better off. You're the one in the driver's seat there. So, it is hard here. But fortunately, working for General Washington, I am in a house of privilege. But even here, we have some shortages. You may think that because we have a fine house around us and a good roof over our heads, that we do not have hardship. But Mrs. Thompson, our housekeeper, could tell you a different story. There was a point at one time that we were so in such need that His Excellency was reduced to rations. Now, the Commander-in-Chief reduced to rations to feed generals, to feed congressmen, to feed governors. So it was the enterprise of Mrs. Thompson that was, she had them gather salt from around the community, and then she went and bartered that salt so that then we were able to purchase more for His Excellency's table and have the proper meal for the Commander-in-Chief. So it's the servants that keep this household going. His Excellency would be hard-pressed to run the army and face all the hardships and solve all the problems that need to be solved if he had to worry about this.
Are most of the servants slaves?
We are quite a mixed group here, just as anyone, any community. Some of us are enslaved, as I and my husband are, and General's valet, William Lee. But our laundress, Peggy, even though she is a Negro as well, she is a free woman. No one has ever owned Peggy, and I would dare anyone to try. She's a fighter if she ever was one. And then Mrs. Thompson, as I mentioned, a fine Irish woman. And she works for a wage. Even though she's 75 years old, she is the hardest worker that you would ever find here. And His Excellency keeps her on as well. So, in fact, when Mrs. Washington is not here, it's Mrs. Thompson who keeps everything running. But we are also very happy when Mrs. Washington arrives. I don't know if happy is the right word. Because when she sweeps in, you can tell that she's been commanding servants ever since she was just as high as your knee, which is a very strong presence. But she's very gentle in her own way. And when she is here, the general is much calmer. So that is why we like to see Mrs. Washington around.
Do you personally prepare meals for General Washington?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. And being with him these past 2 years, I have been able to understand his demands for what he is wishing at the table. I have always worked in households of privilege. I've never been a field hand or anything such like that. I've always worked, for example, for Reverend Mason. He's a fine, upstanding minister in New York. And so that is why I came recommended for General Washington. But there are times that you still need to get used to a new master and what he demands. And apparently, he's very pleased with us because he did keep us on as his servants.
Are there special precautions made for the food, to protect the food that Washington eats?
Most certainly, most certainly. Everything is kept under lock and key. That is usual in households such as a privilege such as the general's, but is particularly important at this time, especially with all the spies and intrigue that may happen. My husband, when we were at Mr. Wentz's farmstead, just back in October, would stay close by the kitchen to make sure that nothing got into the food. So it's quite a responsibility that he has as the head cook for His Excellency.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Now, if you want to start serving, I have plenty of work for you to be done.
After visiting George Washington's headquarters at Valley Forge, we decided to make our drive over to Washington's Crossing. It took about probably 30 minutes, maybe 45 minutes from Valley Forge to get over there. And it is a state park, and I use the crossing quite a bit as a unit in our American Revolution unit. So I've always wanted to see the actual spot and kind of experience the physical location of where Washington made this crossing. And we showed the movie The Crossing. I've probably seen it 50 or 60 times. We've shown it for probably the last 7 or 8 years in class, and the students really enjoy it. If you haven't seen it yet, check it out. It's The Crossing, and it's available from A&E. You can buy it as a DVD. And Jeff Daniels actually plays a really good George Washington in that movie. So anyway, I wanted to see the actual crossing, and my first thought when I saw the actual river was that it really wasn't as wide as I thought it might be. And it's amazing when you think about all the men, all the equipment and things that were shuffled back and forth over that river. I think it took about 11 hours for George Washington to get all of his men and equipment across that night. But at first, when you first see it, it's like, wow, it's not like the Mississippi, it's not like the Missouri even. But in a driving snowstorm, blizzard-like conditions, you're trying to do it under the stealth of night, I can imagine that it took all of 11 hours to get everybody across. Now, they do have a state park, and we're actually on the Pennsylvania side. I believe there's also a state park on the New Jersey side. But on the Pennsylvania side, we went to the state park. They had a visitor center there, and they have a video that you can see. They have a large painting, the famous painting of the crossing, which, of course, has a lot of historical inaccuracies. And I think that's part of its value, really, as an educational piece. And you can point out some of those things with your students. But beyond that, you can also see several physical buildings associated with the crossing. The first one was I guess they call it a barn, but it's where they house the Durham boats that they use for the reenactments. So it's not the actual Durham boats, from 1776, but they are replicas, and it's amazing how big these things are. And we're talking like, 8 or 9 feet across. Some of them were 65 feet long, and the sheer size of them really struck me. On the movie, I don't think they're that large on the actual movie, so that was really neat to see, where you can actually see the Durham boats. And then you can also go into McCulkey's Tavern. It's one of the places that Washington met to actually formulate the plans for the crossing, and they have a building there that's about half original, and then the second half is actually was done a little bit later. But for $4 or $5 a person, you could do a tour of McCulkey's Tavern, and you could actually be in the room where Washington formulated his plans for the crossing and the attack on Trenton. So that was really amazing to be able to be physically in that room and imagine what must have been going through Washington's mind as he prepared this plan that many of his advisors thought was completely crazy. Now, one quick note on that, we were able to visit that today on July 8th, and we actually read something in the paper this morning that I guess there's a budget impasse that the state is currently undergoing, and I believe on July 9th, tomorrow, that park will be closed until they figure out the budget. So I think that from what I know of the subject, very, very, very limited amount just from an outsider, it looks like the state park is being played as kind of a pawn in this budget impasse, and hopefully they get that resolved soon, because it'd be a shame to see that place not open when people show up to actually tour it. I mean, I'd have been heartbroken if I would have drove up today and found out that they had closed it, surely, just because it was a budgetary thing in the legislature. So we'll have to keep our eye on that. But I believe as of July 9th, 2007, it'll be closed until further notice. So I hope that turns around soon. All right. Well, tomorrow, Monday, we start our Constitution Center teacher workshop, and it should be an amazing week. We have a lot of things planned as far as activities at the convention center, at the Constitution Center. We also have activities planned as far as like walking tours, Ben Franklin's Philadelphia. We're going to see the major sites of Independence Hall, the Liberty Bell, all those types of things. So really excited about that. We kind of got together a little bit tonight, some of us, and went out to eat and kind of walked around downtown a little bit. And it looks like a great group. We're going to learn a lot from each other. It's a very diverse group. They have teachers from all over the country. So it's always great to be able to really sit down and talk to other people that teach history and find out what they do in their classrooms. So I hope to be doing some podcasts this week from Philadelphia and sharing with you a little bit of the experience. And also, I wanted to remind you that if you have not yet, be sure to send me your name and the city in which you live, And I'm going to put all those in a hat, and at the end of July 2007, I'm going to draw those out and give away two different books. I'm going to give an author-signed copy of Guerrilla Season by Pat Hughes. That's about two boys growing up in Missouri at the start of the Civil War. Then I'm also going to give away a copy of Manhunt, The 12-Day Search for Lincoln's Killer. So I'm going to draw those out of a hat on August 1st. I'm actually going to have my three-year-old daughter pick those out. I'm going to put everybody's name that gets sent in on an index card and have her pick two of them out, and then I'll mail those out. So that's just a little way for me to have listener appreciation, kind of tell you thank you for listening to the podcast. And again, all you have to do is send me your name and your city, and then once I pull those out of a hat, I'll contact you via the email you send, and then ask you for your mailing address so I can get the book to you. So again, if you want to do that, you can email me at speakingofhistory@gmail.com, and you can also email any comments to that number or to that email address. And then also, if you want to check out the blog, I do have some pictures up of some of the recent things we've been doing in Philadelphia, and I also added some great pictures from Gettysburg, and that's available at www.speakingofhistory.blogspot. So, thanks for listening, and continue to listen. We'll have some great things coming from Philadelphia for you next week, and remember, history is so much more than just a bunch of boring old dead guys. Thanks, and we'll talk again soon. Bye. The Speaking of History podcast is produced by Eric Langhorst in Liberty, Missouri, under a Creative Commons license. Visit the website for show notes and links to material in the podcast at www.speakingofhistory.blogspot.com. The podcast is also available on iTunes. Please email all comments and questions to speakingofhistory@gmail.com. Background music for the intro is Z from James Underberg from PodSafe Audio. Thanks for listening.